The lazy motherfucker version of you. I'm talking about the upgraded biggest boss version. How does that person spend their time each day? What trade-offs and sacrifices were they willing to make? When you compare the two breakdowns side by side, it starts to become clear where you're handling your business and where you may need to tighten up. The lifestyle changes you need to make, the bad habits you have to cut out, or the people you might need some distance from. You need to have a clear sense of who you are and who you want to become in order to determine the changes you need to make. And then you need to hold yourself accountable and execute those changes. If you aren't willing to make changes, you shouldn't expect your situation to change. What separates great players from all-time great players is their ability to self-assess, diagnose weaknesses, and turn those flaws into strengths. Kobe Bryant. As long as you're spending your time wisely, try not to focus too much on what time it is. I know you've heard the expression, Rome wasn't built in a day. The idea is to remain patient when you're working toward your goals because all great things take time. People get confused and think hustling hard means moving fast. You don't need to move fast. You need to move correctly. Sometimes the heaviest tank on the battlefield moves the slowest. I wouldn't go so far as to say I've got a bad album in my catalog, but numbers don't lie, and I have my best performing album, and I have my worst performing album. Going off that, the closest I've come to dropping a dud was when I rushed my creative process and released 2 albums in 1 year. I've always prioritized quality over quantity, but there were extenuating circumstances at the time. Meek Mill had gotten locked up for a probation violation, and his highly anticipated sophomore album, Dreams Worth More Than Money, had to get pushed back. As the leader of MMG, I tried to step up for the team and put some numbers on the board in the fourth quarter by dropping another album. But there was a price to pay for rushing my creative process. When Hood Billionaire dropped in 2014, I saw the lowest first week sales of my career. The reviews from critics weren't great either. The frustrating part was that that album had so much potential. It had so many dope ideas and concepts, and I knew that if I'd taken the necessary time to meticulously fine-tune and perfect that same track list of songs the way I normally do, the response would have been much different. You can't rush greatness. I know remaining patient is easier said than done, especially when you've been waiting on something a long time and you want it real bad. Believe me, I've been there. If you're like me, Rome wasn't built in a day probably isn't going to give you much peace of mind. If Rome wasn't built in a day, well, then I need to know how many fucking days that shit took. Unfortunately, I can't answer that for you. You're going to have to look that one up in a history book. I most definitely can't tell you how long it will take you to reach your goals. Every come up has its own timeline. So as best as you can, try not to get too hung up on when everything is going to come together. Concentrate on what is coming together. I might not be able to tell you how long it takes to build an empire, but I already told you how all empires are built. By getting up every day and laying bricks. The when part is up to God. And he has his own master plan that's more complicated than you or I could even begin to understand. You've got to trust that he always knows what he's doing, even during your darkest moments when it feels like he may have forgotten about you. The closest I ever came to giving up on my dream was right before it finally came true. I remember the specific moment vividly. This must have been 2003 or 2004. I'd driven up to Fort Myers, where I'd gotten booked to perform at a small club. I was paid $250 for my services. Believe it or not, $250 was all it took to book me at the time. I don't remember much from the club. My shows weren't very memorable back then. But I do know that by the end of the night, I was exhausted, I was drunk, high, sleep deprived, and all I wanted was to get some rest. But I couldn't bring myself to spend the little bit of paper I just made on a motel. Most of my $250 payday was already going toward gas money since Fort Myers is almost 3 hours away from Miami. And the club wasn't paying for lodging and transportation. So when we left the club, I tossed my keys to my homie Peanut and told him take us back to Miami. I hopped in the passenger seat of my truck and closed my eyes. I figured we'd be back in the crib by the time I woke up. The problem was, I wasn't the only one who was drunk and tired. Peanut was too. We hadn't been on the road more than 20 minutes when I woke up to the sound and sight of my Cadillac Escalade drifting off the highway. I looked over and Peanut was asleep at the wheel. I shouted out, but it was too late. A few seconds and flips later, my car was upside down in the median. When the police showed up at the scene, they put me in handcuffs and told me I was under arrest. I couldn't believe it. I wasn't the one behind the wheel. It turned out I had an outstanding warrant out of Broward County. I was taken to a local police precinct where I sat in a holding cell for hours while my homies hustled up some funds for my bail. Sitting in that cell that night, I felt ready to walk away from music. My head was pounding from the accident. My truck was totaled. I was locked up and my homies were hitting their mamas for bail money. And for what? So I could drive 3 hours to perform at a hole-in-the-wall club for $250? Between the wreck and these new criminal charges, this trip to Fort Myers was going to cost me thousands. Money I didn't have. I thought about the crowd at the club hours earlier while I'd performed. Not one person there was fucking with my music. Nobody had come to that club to see me. They were all waiting for me to get off the fucking stage. The more I thought about my situation, the more my negative thoughts spiraled. This wasn't just a bad night. Things just weren't working out for me in general. I was going on 10 years of trying to make it, and I had little to show for all of my pain and struggle. My first deal with Suave House Records had fizzled out. My current deal with Slip and Slide Records seemed to be on a similar trajectory. Maybe this hip-hop shit just wasn't going to pan out for me. Maybe I should just get a desk job somewhere. What I didn't know in that moment was that everything I had dreamed of and worked for was on the verge of coming true. As low as I was that night, I didn't end up throwing in the towel. I picked myself back up and got back to work. A few months later, I heard the beat for what would become Hustlin', and the rest is history. My whole life changed. I share that story to say this. The temptation to fold and wave the white flag is going to be strongest when the finish line is closer than you can see. So when you feel like giving up, take that as a signal to keep going a little bit longer. The reason you can't see the finish line yet is because it's right around the corner. Hard times come with getting money. So if you're going through those hard times, don't stop now. You're only one play away from changing everything. What I will say about the win is this. Don't ever put a deadline on your dreams. I hear people say, if I don't make it by the time I'm 30, then I'm just gonna give up. To me, that says you really don't want it that bad. Having that mindset is like starting a marathon with a lead weight around your neck. You might as well not even try if you're going into something already thinking about your exit. You can always give up later. Don't start out with that type of negative energy in the back of your mind. If you really love something, then make it your life. In for a penny, in for a pound. Fuck a time limit. Smash that hourglass. One final thought. I don't wear my wristwatches so that I can tell the time. I've got an iPhone for that. The function of my watch is so that I can walk into a room anywhere in the world and introduce myself to everyone without having to say one word. Chapter 6. Teamwork makes the dream work. I taught all my niggas how to fish. Some caught more than others. Some said they'd rather be fed. Some passed me up in the process. But at the end of it all, I know I ain't hide the game from my people, and I'm real for that. Nipsey Hussle, 2017. As much fun as I was having cutting my grass, I knew I wouldn't be out on my tractor every week forever. Once the lockdown got lifted and things started to get back to normal, that would no longer be the best use of my time. As much as I strive to be hands-on and maintain a baseline level of involvement in all of my affairs, I can't do it all. I'm an artist and entertainer before anything else. I need to be able to focus on what I do best and delegate other tasks to people that I trust. I'm blessed to have an incredible team that's behind me. I wouldn't be where I'm at without them. I have my mama, Ella, and my sister, Renee, my most trusted confidants, who have a hand in everything that I do. I have Yvette, MMG's general manager, who connects all the dots in the music industry. I have Lex running point on promotions, marketing, and branding. I have my DJ, Sam Sneak. I have Slab by my side every time I hit the stage to help hype up the crowd. I have my road manager, Jeter Kate, who makes sure everything runs smoothly when I'm out of town. I have my security, Jerry and Ducky, who keep the fuck boys from around me. I've got Skinny and Tom holding shit down at the Atlanta estate, and Kano and Shortlegs in Miami. I have my criminal defense attorney, Steve Sadow, and my entertainment lawyer, LaRon. I may be the head of this empire, but all these people make up the backbone. The backbone consists of many vertebrae, and if just one of them is out of alignment, the whole body suffers. That means that the people you choose to surround yourself with is not a decision to take lightly. Your network affects your net worth. It's hard to make the right moves if you're running with the wrong people. Whenever you hear stories about an athlete or entertainer going broke, you usually hear about how many people they were taking care of, how they had become an ATM for all their friends and family members, until one day the money faucet stopped dripping and it all came crashing down. That could never happen to me because I don't associate with blood-sucking leeches. The people who I surround myself with aren't around to ride their successful friends' coattails. I like to think I've blessed my people with opportunities to improve their lives, but I've never been someone's meal ticket. All of the people you see around me are bringing something to the table, so it's my responsibility to make sure everybody eats. I'm not saying I don't hire or invest in my close friends and family members. Most of those names I just mentioned are my day ones. I believe the loyalty that you find in people who were down when you had nothing is hard to replicate. If someone is going to have a hand in your success, you want it to be someone who gives a fuck about you. When people who don't genuinely care about you are responsible for making decisions that impact you, those decisions are usually going to be in their best interests, not yours. But it's one thing to be friends and family, and it's another thing when business is involved. So if I put someone on the payroll, that means we're on the same page when it comes to getting money. I have a few lazy motherfuckers in my life who I love from the bottom of my heart, but there are zero lazy motherfuckers in my life who I subsidize. I would be doing them a disservice if I did that. A true friend is someone who pushes you and encourages you to become the best version of yourself. They don't enable your bad habits and tendencies. When you find like-minded people who are loyal and on the same page as you, those are the people you want to keep close and build with. That's your power circle. Don't take these people for granted because that never ends well. That's the quickest way to plant seeds of disloyalty and insubordination in your crew. And that shit will spread like cancer. If you only try to extract value from your people without giving it back, eventually that's going to come back to haunt you. Those people will only be around for as long as they need you. And when the tables turn and the day comes when you need them more than they need you, they're going to be nowhere to be found. You have to empower your people. As soon as I got in the game, I reached back and pulled Gunplay, Torch, and Young Breed up to the big leagues with me and introduced the world to Triple C's. I didn't even have my own imprint deal with Def Jam, but I told him if they wanted to put out another Rick Ross album, they were going to have to put out a Triple C's album first. The homies I come up with has stuck it out with me through all the trials and tribulations when they could have jumped ship. I had to reward their loyalty and give them an opportunity to win with me. I've seen niggas get to a position of power and forget to put their team on. It's as if they fall in love with being the one in the spotlight and don't want to share it with anyone. They want to be the top dog and they don't want anyone underneath them to outgrow their positions. But I'm not interested in stacking up my own private collection of victories and hoarding them for myself. I couldn't consider myself to be successful if I wasn't helping other people succeed too. I don't hold my people back. I don't hire my homies for jobs they can grow into. I hire them for jobs they can one day grow out of. At times, That can be bittersweet when it means having to let someone go off and do their own thing. But just because something is sad or hard to do doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It's really a blessing when that happens. If you truly love someone, you want to see them boss up, whether it's with you or on their own. Take Meek Mill and Wale, for example. You don't see them next to me all the time like you did 10 years ago. That's by design. Meek and Wale are bosses now, too. There was a time when their rank was soldiers under the general, and they played that position well until they graduated from that rank. They're still MMG, and we're always going to be partners and get money together. But there came a point when I recognized it was time for them to focus on building their own empires. That was the plan all along. When Meek started pushing his Dream Chasers imprint, I went and got the logo tatted on my fucking face. He repped my shit for so long and helped me build my empire, I couldn't wait to do the same for him. I felt the same way about Wale's Every Blue Moon. I apply that same principle to all my homies' ventures. I champion them like they're mine. I've always looked at it like we're all in this shit together. Going back to what I was saying earlier, for argument's sake, let's imagine a scenario where one day I go broke. Okay, now that I've gotten that out of my system, let me regain my composure and try that one more time. Let's say they bring back prohibition, and I'm no longer allowed to sell Luc Belair. Or the whole world goes vegan, and so I have to close my Wingstops because eating chicken is considered animal cruelty. Better yet, let's say I suffer a seizure or a stroke that leaves me so fucked up I'm left with an alligator arm and I can't even hold up a microphone to rap ever again. What do you think happens to all the people around me? Do you think everybody goes broke because their money faucet got turned off? Guess again. All of my people have gotten themselves to a place where they're in a position to help me get back on my feet if I should fall. My mama and sister handle a lot of my business affairs. But these days, they also have investments that are completely independent of me. My mama owns more than a dozen rental properties. My sister has a car dealership. If you're in the Olive Branch, Mississippi area and looking to get a new car, go hit up B&J Auto Sales and ask for Tawanda Roberts. Don't even worry if your credit is not the best. Everybody gets approved at B&J Auto. At this point, I don't even know about half the shit my people are involved in. I'm trying to tell you, I gave them an opportunity, and then they all went out and got fucking rich. I swear to God, I can't remember the last time anyone in my inner circle asked me for a handout. It's been years. That's what happens when you pick the right team and empower your people. Chapter 7. Stack your paper. The government was cutting everybody $1,200 stimulus checks. Millions of Americans had lost their jobs due to the pandemic, and the way things were looking, they weren't going to be getting back to work anytime soon. $1,200 didn't seem like very much. You can only stretch a stack so far. So what was going to happen once those stimmy checks dried up? Unless they had some more savings stashed away, pretty soon a lot of people were going to be jammed up. I can see how from the outside looking in, it might appear that I've been irresponsible with my earnings. I do have a 235-acre estate. I do have a 350,000-gallon swimming pool. I do have a lot of cars. I do buy jewelry. I do own 3 horses. I have all the extravagant rapper shit and then some. Guilty as charged. But remember, I bought the promised land at a heavy discount. Then I turned it into an asset and monetized it. In 2017, Sony Pictures cut a nice check to film Superfly here. That movie had a $30 million budget. 2 years later, Paramount Pictures used the estate as the primary shooting location for Coming to America. That had a $60 million budget. I've had a lot more movie producers come by because they were considering using it. Even when they don't decide to use it, they still have to pay me just to visit. I rent my cars out too. The promised land is an asset that generates income, not a liability that drains my finances. The place is already paying for itself. I do enjoy luxuries, but my assets far outweigh my liabilities. I've never bought something that I couldn't afford to buy twice. I don't live beyond my means. I might be a big spender, but I've always been a much bigger saver. When I signed my major label deal with Def Jam, I received a 7-figure advance. After a decade of struggle, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't tempted to finally reward myself for all my years of unpaid labor. As big as that advance was, I could have very quickly blown through that million. For years, I had dreamed of all the things I would have once I made it, and now there was nothing stopping me from going out and acquiring those things. But I didn't. For the next 9 months, I pretended that money didn't exist. I put my head down and got back to work. I was in high demand, so I hit the road and gave the people what they wanted. I performed hustling for every venue that had a bag for the boss. I saved that money too. The deposits and the back ends. It wasn't until Port of Miami debuted at number one that I felt comfortable making my first big purchase. I bought my studio house in Atlanta, which I still own to this day. Coming up in Miami, I saw a lot of hustlers. I'm talking about in the streets and in the rap game. Get fast money and lose it even faster. Miami is a city where motherfuckers like to show out. It's not a place where people are quiet about getting money. In New England, you might pull up to a red light and have no idea that the guy in the Prius next to you is sitting on $100 million. Miami is not like that. Here, people exaggerate how much money they actually have. Most of those Lamborghinis you see on South Beach are rented. Uncle Luke was the founding father of hip-hop in Miami, and I saw with my own eyes how quickly he went from dropping double platinum albums to being forced to declare bankruptcy and sell off his entire catalog. My worst nightmare was that something similar could happen to me. I knew my major label deal didn't guarantee me major success. Def Jam's roster was full of artists they'd signed and since forgotten about. I hadn't come into the game with a loyal underground fan base that had been supporting my music for years and would continue to support me if this deal with Def Jam didn't work out. All of my success to date was based entirely on one hit record. That indicated to me that it was too soon for me to start celebrating and spending money. That advance was my only safety net in the world. Seeing the pandemic play out was a harsh reminder of how important it is to have a rainy day fund. I know most people aren't in the position I'm in to keep duffel bags of unmarked bills and gold bullion buried in discreet locations across the Southeast United States. Most people live check to check. Regardless, I think everyone has something they spend their money on that they know they could live without. I already told you about a few of my vices. What are yours? The difference is I've gotten myself to a point where I can afford to have luxuries. Until you can, I encourage you to figure out what you can sacrifice to start building some savings. I can't tell you when your rainy day fund is going to come in handy, but I can guarantee you that that day will come. Why do you think I titled my first memoir Hurricanes? Storms are a major part of life. The only thing that you can control is how prepared you are to handle them when they hit. When it rains, it pours. And when it does, nobody is coming with an umbrella to keep you dry. You're going to be on your own. So you'll be grateful if you tucked your last tax refund instead of throwing it in the air at Magic City. When you make the decision to prioritize saving and investing your money over spending, you make a trade-off. You're choosing to sacrifice immediate gratification in exchange for the possibility of an even better outcome in the future. It's not a hard concept to wrap your head around, but when you're from a conflict and crime-ridden area, making that calculation is a little more complicated. Think about it. If you're living in a world where there's a real significant chance you can lose your life, you're going to be less inclined to sacrifice the present to invest in a future that isn't guaranteed. You're also probably going to be more likely to engage in self-destructive behavior, cheating, lying, stealing, because you're not considering the devastating long-term consequences of that shit. If that mindset applies to you, you're going to have to rewire your thinking and start playing the long game. Once you've built up your rainy day fund in case of emergencies, you can start acquiring assets that earn passive income. Bosses don't just work for money. They put their money to work. Whether it's through buying stocks, bonds, or real estate, you want to work toward establishing passive streams of income. Assets are a key part of accumulating wealth. Work leads to money. Money leads to assets. Assets lead to wealth. Good financial habits build wealth, and bad ones destroy it. If you spend everything you earn, an increase in money will just result in an increase in spending, and you'll never be able to build wealth. The best thing that money will ever buy you is some peace of mind. When you get to a certain level of money, it takes the pressure off and frees you up to focus on the things you really care about. Financial freedom is life's greatest stress reliever, and you'll never achieve it if you spend your money as fast as you accumulate it. So stay focused on stacking your paper. Chapter 8, War Ready. My military-grade Humvee finally arrived. As the highly decorated five-star general of the Maybach Music Group, I thought it was only right I get one. It was perfect. Well, it was almost perfect. There were still a few modifications I wanted to make. I was planning to take out the black seats and replace them with custom ones made from Louis Vuitton leather. I felt the brown monogram canvas would contrast with the green camouflage exterior paint job beautifully. Shout out to my homie T over at Exclusive Game for making that happen. I was also looking into the legality of strapping a 50 caliber Gatling gun to the roof. I hired two new members to my estate's security team, K9 Doc and K9 Midas, two highly trained Belgian Malinois guard dogs. During the extensive interview process, Doc and Midas told me personally how much they despise trespassers. My prayers go out to the next lost soul who thinks they can just stroll into the promised land without a proper invitation. I hadn't beefed up security at the estate in response to an incident. I did it in anticipation of future unforeseen circumstances. Times of peace are when you prepare for battle. If you wait until you're under siege to see what's in your war chest, you're gonna get slaughtered. You need to premeditate as many moves as you can for all potential scenarios. You need to remain war ready. Think chess, not checkers. The only time you should be thinking checkers is when you're hungry. In that case, I suggest you make your way over to my fine dining establishment located at the corner of 183rd Street and 27th Avenue in Carroll City. Order yourself a Big Buford, a chili dog, and a blue slush. Tell them Rosé sent you. Once you've had something to eat, get back to plotting your moves on your chessboard. A chess master is never caught off guard. Whatever move their opponent makes, they already have a counterattack ready to go. They don't even have to think about it because they already had a plan in place for what they would do in the event that happened. They've prepared for every possible scenario so they don't start panicking when one of their pawns gets picked off. They're ready to take some losses and make adjustments as they advance across the board. They know that losses come with the game, and so they stick to the plan, strategically backing their opponent into a corner until there's nowhere left for them to go. At that point, it's game over. Checkmate. Then you reset the board and prepare for the next game. Being war-ready isn't just about having a contingency plan in place for when shit hits the fan. It's deeper than buying tanks and guard dogs. What I'm really trying to stress to you is the importance of preparation. Because it's not just the storms you need to prepare for. You have to be ready for life's blessings, too. A once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that suddenly presents itself is worthless if you're not in the right position to capitalize on it. I was talking about having a rainy day fund in case of emergencies. But ideally, you also want to have some funds stashed away for when a life-changing investment opportunity comes your way. The importance of planning and preparation goes both ways, and if you're not prepared, you better believe someone else will be. Your loss will be their gain. In his fifth book, Mastery, Robert Greene writes that a fighter who enters the ring with a clear sense of purpose and strategy, and with the confidence that comes from complete preparation, has a much better chance of prevailing. I was reminded of those words during a recent visit from one of my good homies, four-time world champion boxer Adrian About Billions Broner. When it comes to talent and ability, there's not a lot of motherfuckers who can step in the ring and outbox AB. But when AB came by the house, he told how he was in the process of getting his career back on track after digging himself a deep hole. My homie fell off the pound-for-pound rankings in recent years after losing important fights he should have won. He'll be the first to admit those losses were due to lack of preparation and focus. He let himself get heavy between fights, and then when it was time to get ready for the next one, he had to put all his energy toward making weight at the last minute when he should have been studying tape on his opponent and sharpening his skills. He's paid a steep price for that lack of preparation. It altered the course of his career. It felt good to see my dog. He finally seemed focused, and I truly believe his best performances are still to come. I'm not saying any of this to speak down on my brother. I'm just saying that there are consequences to not being war ready. The best fighters don't let themselves get fat in between fights. They stay in elite shape year round. Up-and-coming contenders never know when Floyd Mayweather or Conor McGregor's scheduled opponent is going to get injured, and the promoters are going to be looking for a last-minute replacement fighter. Getting a chance to prove yourself against the best of your generation would be the opportunity of a lifetime for any prize fighter. But if they're not prepared to step on the scale and make weight, then it's just a wasted opportunity. 2 weeks after my Humvee got delivered, a 46-year-old black man was killed in Minneapolis, Minnesota. His name was George Floyd. George Floyd died at the hands of the Minneapolis Police Department after a white police officer named Derek Chauvin put his knee into his neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. His fellow officer stood by and did nothing as brother George ran out of oxygen, begging for his life and calling out for his mama. They did nothing when he told them he couldn't breathe. That's how he died. Learning about George Floyd's life hurt my heart. He and I were around the same age, and like me, George had gone to college on a football scholarship and dropped out to pursue a passion for music. In the 90s, he'd been down with DJ Screw and the Screwed Up Click in Houston. I was angry, and I was disgusted, but I wasn't surprised. As upsetting as that video was, I wasn't shocked in the least bit. I was 4 years old when 5 white Miami-Dade police officers beat Arthur McDuffie to death in Liberty City. I was 6 when they killed Neville Johnson in Overtown. I was 13 when they killed Clement Lloyd and Alan Blanchard in Overtown. I was 15 when they beat down Rodney King in Los Angeles. I was 38 when Darren Wilson killed Michael Brown in Ferguson. I got the keys to the city. Still we left in the cold. Hands in the sky. Still was left in the road. Ribbon in the sky, Michael Brown, another soul. Stole by the system. Black men, we pay the toll. The price is your life. Uncle Sam won a slice. Black dress cold now, we looting in the night. Now we throwing Molotovs in this Holocaust. And I know they hate to hear me screaming, I'm a boss. Rick Ross, Don't Shoot, 2014. I was 38 when they killed Tamir Rice in Cleveland. I was 39 when they killed Freddie Gray in Baltimore. And I was 44 when they killed George Floyd in Minneapolis. So I wasn't surprised by what happened to George Floyd or that people took to the streets and started burning shit. How can anyone expect people who have been targeted and persecuted for so long to not eventually explode? I had plans to go down to Miami for a rally the following week and march alongside Trayvon Martin's father in Miramar. But when I saw what was happening 20 minutes away from the promised land, I felt compelled to take action. Protesters were clashing with police downtown, and they were getting hit with tear gas, batons, and rubber bullets. The governor had declared a state of emergency in Fulton County and dispatched 500 National Guard members to assist local law enforcement. If the crackers were coming in their Humvees to help the police, then I was coming in mine on behalf of the people. They say we just a bunch of thugs, don't stand for nothing, disgrace to our race, don't belong in public. It was us against the world from the first day. Let us bow our heads. May we all pray. Throwing bricks at the man, we gonna make it. Genocide not in the plans, we gonna make it. Pray my son understand, we gonna make it. No God holding our hands, we gonna make it. Rick Ross, we gonna make it. Black Dollar, 2015. As I rode through the streets of downtown Atlanta, I couldn't help but think this time felt different. Even though I'd seen this movie many times, for some reason, the stakes felt higher. Like, just maybe it could actually lead to something. Maybe it was because of the pandemic. People were already at a tipping point, and George Floyd's murder had sent them over the edge. These were dark times we were living in. It seemed like we might be on the verge of a second civil war. I prayed for peace, but I was prepared for war. Either way, I'd be ready. Chapter 9. Your hustle determines your salary. Ambition is priceless. That's something that's in your veins, and I doubt that ever changed. Wale featuring Rick Ross and Meek Mill, Ambition. Ambition, 2011. Riding around in my new Humvee had me feeling like Master P when he brought the gold tank out on the basketball court for the Make Him Say music video. That was the one where he had the gorilla mascot doing acrobatic dunks and Shaquille O'Neal made a cameo. That whole No Limit era was so legendary. Make Him Say was the record that took Master P and No Limit Records out of the Calliope projects of New Orleans and introduced them to the mainstream in 1998. I was 22 years old, and I was heavy in the streets at the time. I graduated from my neighborhood and started taking trips out of town where there was a lot less competition and a lot more money to be made. My dream to make it as a rapper wasn't paying the bills yet. It wasn't even bringing in a penny. So I was 10 toes deep in the dope game. But that year was a major turning point in my life. As Master P's master plan was coming together, my world was closing in on me. Federal indictments started coming down, and it seemed like damn near everybody I knew and looked up to growing up was getting locked up and sent away for decades. Those events were what really shook me and prompted me to go all in on music. Like me, Master P had early dreams of playing ball in the big leagues. He'd gone to college on a basketball scholarship, but dropped out his freshman year to pursue a different path as an entertainer and entrepreneur. It wasn't a seamless transition. For a while, he had one foot in and one foot out of the streets like I did. It wasn't until his brother was murdered in 1990 that he decided to wash his hands of the street life. I could identify with Master P's story. So when Make 'Em Say blew up and No Limit took over the rap game, Master P was the living, breathing embodiment of a young nigga from the South who got it out the mud. You had to respect his hustle. I was taking a trip down memory lane the other day, and I came across my first ever on-camera interview. It was at Po' Boy Studios in Miami. You can pull it up on YouTube. This was back in the early 2000s. I didn't even have a beard yet. At the time, I was a disgruntled artist signed to Slip and Slide Records, and I wanted to get off the label and go independent. I talked a lot of shit in that interview, but I also tipped my hat to P for giving me the blueprint on how to build an independent empire. Thinking of a master plan. Now I could put $100,000 in the palm of a nigga's hands. I need to hit a lick drastically. I ain't talking Slip and Slide, but Master P. Rick Ross, 2003 Freestyle. I could find a way to credit Master P's influence on me in every chapter of this book if I wanted. The way he negotiated his deals and advocated for taking less money up front in exchange for retaining ownership and independence over big cash advances from major labels. The way he built his brand through street-level guerrilla marketing and the iconic gold tank. The way he put his people on and made No Limit a true family-owned and operated black business. All of his different ventures outside of music. No Limit Clothing, No Limit Films, No Limit Sports Management. You can find a Master P version of every aspect of my success. Getting money only time for me I ever be at peace. I'ma build a mansion, sit it on Virginia Key. I'm the only one who did it big as Master P. Talking nine figures, rapping on these niggas' beats. Rick Ross, Richer Than I've Ever Been. Richer Than I've Ever Been, 2021. So it was a no-brainer when an opportunity to partner up with Master P and James Fly Lindsay on Rap Snacks came across my plate. Not only had I admired Master P for decades, but I also knew James, who has worked closely with Meek Mills for years, and I held him in high regard. James founded Rap Snacks all the way back in 1994, but it wasn't until recently that the company really started to take off and establish itself as a force to be reckoned with in the snack foods category. That's a testament to James's character. You got to be a true hustler to be willing to wait 25 years to see your plans come to fruition. I had a lot of respect for Rap Snacks because it was a company born out of hip-hop culture. This wasn't some huge multinational snacks corporation that was trying to use hip-hop to make themselves some money. This was a black-owned business I wanted to support and see win, whether or not I was getting money with them. The company had seen a lot of success with its product launches with the Migos, Cardi B, Boosie, Fabulous, and Lil Yachty. Now James and Master P were gearing up to take Rap Snacks to the next level by expanding their distribution network and extending their product line beyond potato chips into ramen noodles and beverages. I wanted in on that expansion. James and I chopped it up and started brainstorming about different products and flavor profiles that aligned with my brand and complemented their roster. A few months later, we made it official. And now my sweet chili lemon pepper potato chips and lobster bisque flavored ramen noodles are available in over 4,200 Walmart stores nationwide. Am I really just a narcissist because I wake up to a bowl of lobster bisque? Rick Ross, I love my bitches. God forgives, I don't. 2012. At the root of all of Master P's moves and all of mine was the same thing, ambition. As much as Master P or any of my influences may have inspired me and shared the game, he didn't give me the burning desire that pushed me every day and kept me going when I had every reason in the world to give up. That came from within. Ambition isn't something another person can give you. When it comes to being successful, ambition and passion are the most important assets a person can have. They're much more important than any God-given talent, and that's coming from one of the most talented motherfuckers you've ever met in your life. Wale and Meek Mill's successes are my proudest achievements as the CEO of Maybach Music Group. We've made a lot of money and classic records together over the last 10 years, but my true profit has been getting to watch them live out their dreams. I remember when I first signed them like it was yesterday. Wale was a year removed from getting dropped from Interscope Records. Meek was just starting to get a buzz back going after a prison bid had cost him his first record deal with T.I. Neither of them had much when we first met, just their dreams. Now, they're both multimillionaires. Getting to be a part of their journeys is more rewarding than any points I had on their albums. I have to admit, I got lucky with those two. The reason I say I got lucky is because when I made the decision to sign them to MMG, I did it for the wrong reasons. I signed them purely based on their talent and potential. I had just launched my label imprint at Warner Brothers, and I still had a lot to learn as a record label executive. Talent and potential were all I thought I was supposed to be looking for back then. I didn't even think to evaluate them based on their character. I just assumed that every artist wanted to make it as bad as I did and was willing to do whatever it took. I was wrong when I made that general assumption, but lucky for me, Wale and Meek did want it that bad. Not every artist I signed had that same ambition. I can't lie. That took a toll on my spirit. It's part of the reason why I've taken a break from signing new artists in recent years. Those types of disappointments are frustrating, especially when you feel a certain sense of responsibility for someone else's success. When I sign an artist, I make a debt to them that I'm going to work harder for them than anyone else they could have signed to. So it's frustrating and discouraging when you get the feeling that you want to see someone win more than they want it for themselves. A team can't win a championship if the coach wants to win more than the players do. There are plenty of artists who have sold more records than I have. I have one platinum album, and it took 10 years to move 1 million copies of that. Plenty of artists can charge more for a verse than I can. I don't draw the biggest crowds or have the most followers on social media. So how is it that when it comes to getting money, very few of my peers have accumulated my level of wealth? How's that possible? The answer is simple. I wanted it more than them. So I outworked all these niggas. Name a motherfucker who hustled harder than Rosé. I've been on the road picking up back ends every weekend for 15 years straight. Aside from this pandemic, the only break I ever took was when I started having seizures. And I only did that because my mama begged me to. If she hadn't, I would have kept going. I wouldn't give a fuck if I had a seizure on stage and started doing the electric slide. But you gotta pay me extra if you wanna see that. Triple beam dreams, the ghetto is my reality. I'm from where your hustle determines your salary. Rick Ross featuring Nas, Triple Beam Dreams, Rich Forever, 2012. Thomas Edison, the greatest inventor in American history, once said, "Genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration." That means that when it comes to being successful, your ambition and your work ethic are much more important assets than any God-given talent you're blessed with. That's coming from Ricky Rosé, one of the most talented motherfuckers you've ever seen in your life. I hope this book will inspire someone to get up off their ass and work towards their goals, but it's not gonna do the work for them. You have to have ambition. The dream is free, but the hustle is sold separately. And your hustle is what ultimately determines your salary. Chapter 10, Manage the Emotions. Crib bigger than a church. Lord, know I'm blessed. 5 different lawyers. Lord, know I'm stressed. A punch in the face gets you 300K. Ask Vlad. Now he's back to making minimum wage. Rick Ross featuring CeeLo. Tears of Joy. Teflon Dawn, 2010. Every time I perform, my goal is to give my fans a show that they'll remember for the rest of their lives. When I'm in album mode, my work isn't finished until I know I've made the best music that I'm capable of making. I don't give a fuck how many times the label calls begging me to turn it in. When I get behind a brand like Wingstop or Luke Belair, I care about how many wings and bottles they sell as much as my album sales. I'm a passionate motherfucker. I take all this shit personally. I'm emotionally invested in everything I do, but I don't allow my emotions to dictate my decisions. That hasn't always been the case. One area of my life where I've experienced growth is how I handle stressful situations. I used to be a much more reactive person. I've slapped a lot of motherfuckers over minor infractions. Before they even knew they'd offended me, their glasses went flying off their faces. Coming up in Carroll City, you had to be that way. Reactions are survival-oriented, and in the streets, the ability to react quickly to a dangerous situation could mean the difference between life and death. But my life today is much different than it was back in the day. And as I've gotten older, the instincts that once served me started doing me a disservice. Halfway into 2008, my rap career was on an upward trajectory. My second album, Triller, debuted at number one on the Billboard 200, beating the curse of the sophomore slump and silencing any remaining haters who claimed I'd be a one-hit wonder. Things were going well, but that summer, I got caught off guard with something I didn't see coming. One of the hip-hop gossip blogs published a report that I'd once worked as a correctional officer. They weaponized that information against me and used it to say I was a fraud and that my backstory was full of lies. All of a sudden, it seemed like the people were turning against me and my career was in jeopardy. That whole situation caught me flat-footed because this was something I'd never made an effort to conceal. This was something that people who knew me knew about, and it had never been an issue. Niggas in the street knew what I was about. In Miami, there were zero questions about my credibility. If there had been, I promise you someone would have tried to step on my toes a long time ago, and they would have quickly found out what time it was. But that never happened. But the streets and the internet are two very different places. And the way the blogs were spinning the story, Rick Ross was on the ropes. The attack on my character put me in survival mode. My defensive fight or flight instincts kicked in, and I reacted by claiming the rumors weren't true. That was a big mistake on my part, because when they brought the receipts out, it made the situation much worse. Now I'd been caught in a lie, and if I was lying about this, surely I must be lying about everything else. 2 months later, me and my crew ran into one of the bloggers that had been pushing the story. He got his ass beat down, and that felt good in the moment. But it most definitely wasn't worth all the time, energy, and hundreds of thousands of dollars it took to put that situation behind me. My time and money are worth much more to me than any satisfaction I got from seeing a goofball get his eye socket caved in. These days, I deal with bloggers and paparazzi in a totally different way. Regardless of what they say, I don't get defensive. These people are just doing their jobs, and their job is to use me to get ratings and clicks. But my job is to use them for my agenda. Who do you think wins that power struggle? Here's an exchange I had with a TMZ cameraman back in 2013. TMZ. Rick, what's up, dude? How are you doing, bro? Boss. Stop. I tell you the questions. That's Omarion, that's Stally, that's Meek Mill. That's Rocky Fresh. You film what I tell you to film. Self-Made 3 is coming. TMZ. Oh, congrats on that. I saw that on Instagram. Boss. I know you did, but what about Wale's album? What day does that come out? TMZ. June 26th? Boss. No, the 25th. Don't mess that up no more. Now listen, when you see me, you film. You know why? Because I'm the biggest boss you've ever seen. You make sure they don't just play this video one time. You make sure they play this for a week straight. The reality of the whole CO controversy was that I really never had anything to hide in the first place. I knew who I was and the code I'd lived by. I could have just explained the situation and it would have been over with. The blogs could say whatever they wanted, but at the end of the day, the truth would prevail. My success would ultimately be determined by the quality of my music, not a part-time job I held for a year as a teenager. If I'd waited for the emotions of the situation to subside instead of reacting hastily, I would have handled it much better. Emotions are always temporary. Decisions can have permanent effects. A few years later, I lost a lucrative endorsement deal with Reebok following a controversy surrounding a bar on a song called "You Only Know." Once again, my first instinct was to go bad on the company for dropping me. But I'd learned from what had happened in 2008, so I gave myself some space to sit with it. I realized that Reebok had wanted to be in business with me. It was only due to my poor choice of words and bad judgment that this was no longer a viable partnership for a major corporation. Not only that, but if I'd gone on Twitter and said, "Fuck Reebok," I wouldn't have just burned a bridge with them. I would have probably scared off every other company that was considering partnering with me. Who would want to get into business with someone who may shit on them publicly if things go south? I would have made myself a liability. So I had to take responsibility for my actions and apologize to the people I'd offended and to my business partners, whom I'd put in a tough spot. I fucked up again during a radio interview with The Breakfast Club in 2017. Angela Yee asked me why I didn't have any female artists signed to MMG, and I said it was because I would end up fucking her and fucking the business up. There really wasn't any truth to that statement. It was an off-the-cuff comment, an attempt at being funny on a show looking for sound bites. But to all the women out there who knew they had to work twice as hard as men to achieve the same level of success, all while having to duck predatory Harvey Weinstein-type creep motherfuckers, my joke fell flat. Once again, I felt myself getting defensive. Man, fuck this lame cancel culture bullshit, I thought. Anyone who actually knew me knew how much respect I have for women. The two most important players on my team are my mama and my sister. The people at my label who I work closest with are women. My manager's a woman. I got my start in the game ghostwriting for female artists. But once I got over my own ego and pride, I realized none of those things mattered. They were just excuses, and I already told you, excuses don't mean shit. At the end of the day, I'd said something that was hurtful, and there was no reason I shouldn't own up to that. I want to address an insensitive comment I made on a very sensitive issue, especially in a minority-dominated industry like hip-hop. My entire empire's backbone is led by two of the strongest people I know, and they happen to be women, my mother and sister. The operations wouldn't run without them, and I have the highest regard and respect for women in this industry. I have a daughter myself, my most cherished gift in the world. My comment is not a reflection of my beliefs on the issue. A mistake I regret. I hope to use my mistake, my platform, and the community to create positive discussion to implement change on a very important issue. Respect for the ones who stand up to say, "Hey, that isn't right." Now it's time to accept responsibility and do better. I look forward to continuing to work with and support female artists. My discovery process was documented by VH1 on Signed, which premiered last night. Many of the most talented artists you'll see in the running to be the next MMG superstar are female artists. I look forward to clarifying my comments through my support. Thank you to everyone who's going through the journey with me. We're coming out every day stronger. Taking responsibility for your fuck-ups and opening yourself up to criticism is not something I saw a lot of growing up. That type of vulnerability is seen as weakness in the hood, and people prey upon it. When you come into the rap game from the streets, you bring certain things with you, whether you're consciously aware of them or not. So it took me a minute to unlearn some of the things I'd been taught and make the switch from reactions to responses. I still listen to my gut, but most of the problems I face now are not life and death situations. More often than not, they are issues that would benefit from calm, well-thought-out responses. Responses come slower than reactions, but they're always based on more information. Chapter 11. Your bedroom is your office. Work is often seen as a means for making money so we can enjoy that second life that we lead. Even if we derive some satisfaction from our careers, we still tend to compartmentalize our lives in this way. This is a depressing attitude because in the end, we spend a substantial part of our waking life at work. If we experience this time as something to get through on the way to real pleasure, then our hours at work represent a tragic waste of the short time we have to live. Robert Greene, Mastery. I went home last week, back to Clarksdale, Mississippi, the place where it all started for a young Rosé. Usually, I go back pretty often. I've still got a lot of family in the area, but due to the pandemic, it had been a little while. I opted to make the 6-hour drive rather than fly to make sure I didn't catch the fungus and bring it home to my mama. I like making that drive anyway. There ain't a whole lot to see, but riding past the old cotton fields and endless stretches of countryside reminds me how far I've come. I come from a long line of pecan pickers and real niggas. I wonder what the fuck my ancestors would make of me. I made the trip for the grand opening of my newest wing stop, standing alongside my mama, my sister, and Clarksdale's mayor, Chuck Espy. I cut the red ribbon with the blue oversized scissors, and then we all went in and celebrated with a 10-piece of lemon pepper wings. I didn't even have to ask them to separate the flats from the drums for me. They already knew my order. I was now the proud owner of 25 wing stops, but I was especially proud of this location. This one was special. Opening a business is hard enough under normal conditions, but to do it in the middle of a global pandemic requires a whole other level of hustling. I won't bore you with all the details of the planning and preparation that went into opening up this particular location, but just know that it was a 3-year process. Opening up a wing stop in Clarksdale was deeper than just adding another asset to my portfolio. This was about bringing 20 new jobs to the city that birthed me. This was about taking a historic location that had been abandoned for years, Clarksdale's old Greyhound bus depot, and bringing it back to life as a Black-owned business. This was about showing the youth of Clarksdale how much they can rise above their humble beginnings, and when they do, not to forget where they came from and to give back. This was about buying back the block. It's been 10 years since I opened the doors to my first wing stop in 2011. Aside from my music career, it's the only other venture I've been involved with for that long. It's incredible to see the results of a decade of consistent, hard work, especially because Boss Wings LLC was not an overnight success. For the first few years, we were just trying to get out of the red and break even on our investment. Some of our first stores were poorly managed, and it took a lot to turn them around. Now, those same stores that were struggling when we bought them bring in millions of dollars every year. Boss Wings is a family-owned and operated enterprise, and I owe most of its success to my two partners, my mama, Ella, and my sister, Renee. They could explain to you all the nuts and bolts of the fast food franchise game much better than I can. They're the ones who really work on the business plans, scout for potential new locations, and recruit the amazing employees you find at our restaurants. My primary role has been marketing and promoting Wingstop. I think I've done a pretty good job at that. She thinking Philippe's, I'm thinking Wingstop. Fiending lemon pepper, I got my thing cocked. Rick Ross, MC Hammer, Teflon Don 2010. Waving at these bitches and I know these niggas hoish. Take your bitch to get lemon pepper in the new Lotus. Rick Ross, King of Diamonds, Rich Forever, 2011. I hit a lick and went and bought a wing stop, 20 of them. I sprinkle lemon pepper in that re-rock, 20 of them. Gucci Mane featuring Rick Ross, Trap Booming, I'm Up, 2012. Wing stop owner, lemon pepper aroma, young black nigga, barely got a diploma. Rick Ross, Black and White, Mastermind, 2014. Tell the plug that I'm looking for an increase. Wing stop, fat boy need a 10-piece. Rick Ross featuring Jay-Z, The Devil is a Lie, Mastermind, 2014. I want it all, wing stops on every corner. I want them all, and I'm about to build a Benihana. Rick Ross, Bill Gates, Black Dollar, 2015. As soon as I opened my first store, Wingstop became integrated with everything else I had going on. Not just my lyrics, my music videos, my interviews, my photo shoots, my red carpet appearances at award shows, everything. Reppin' Wingstop the way I do came very naturally to me because I was already a consumer of the product. I was eating lemon pepper 10 pieces way before I started selling them. So when I rep Wingstop in a song, it's not like I'm sitting in a studio with my notepad trying to figure out how to insert some product placement in my raps to fulfill some contractual obligation. I have no such obligation. Wingstop is just a part of who I am now. So rapping about eating lemon pepper comes as easily to me as talking about driving a couple of bricks up to Jacksonville. Having that genuine love for a product.